This is the Morning Magazine for April 18th of 2022. I'm your host, Ariana Proctor. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, we kick off a brand new reporting series that will follow the waste streams flowing out of Boulder County. And the CityCast Denver crew sits down with a lifelong cyclist to discuss why the newly approved safety stop is more than just a tweak to transit regulations. At the bottom of the hour, we'll hear the BBC headlines and then the Hightower Lowdown, followed by good old CU with Joe Uhas. Then at 9 a.m., we'll bring you Counterspin, a look at fairness and accuracy in reporting. After that, Carrie Wolfson will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. All that is still ahead this morning, but first these headlines with KGNU's Ellie Stuckrath.
Fire officials have fully contained a blaze that burned through more than 100 acres in Larimer County over the weekend. The so-called 37 East fire began Friday evening north of Lyons, prompting voluntary and mandatory evacuation orders for nearby residents. No structural damage or injuries were reported. A different blaze, known as the Duck Pond Fire, near Gypsum, Colorado, continues to burn at 60% containment. The fire is estimated at 89 acres and temporarily closed I-70 over the weekend. Victims of the Marshall Fire have a new online information portal through which to stay current on county guidelines for rebuilding efforts. RebuildingBetter.org contains resources designed to help with planning and construction processes as people begin to rebuild their homes. The website is intended to encourage the construction of greener and more resilient homes. Some resources on the website include advice on finding discounts and various financing options and implementing wildfire-resistant landscaping. There will also be information on financial incentives from Xcel to promote the construction of high-performance homes. Energy Smart, a residential energy advising service in Boulder County, will maintain and update the website as more resources become available. Green building regulations in place in Louisville prior to the Marshall Fire drew protests from residents who argued the rules can significantly increase free building costs, especially for underinsured homeowners. Rural communities in Colorado will soon receive over $12 million to support public schools, road maintenance, and emergency services through the Secure Rural Schools Program, or SRS. The funding comes from the bipartisan infrastructure law signed by President Joe Biden in November. Colorado Congressman Joe Neguse says the allotment will make a key difference for the state's mountain communities and fund wildfire recovery initiatives. The federal funding will benefit more than 740 rural counties nationwide. Denver Mayor Michael Hancock issued a formal apology on Saturday to the city's Chinese community for permitting mob violence that largely destroyed Denver's Chinatown in October of 1880. According to CBS, Denver is only the fifth city in the country and the first outside of California to apologizing for allowing mobs to riot through Chinese communities in the late 19th century. A bill currently before the legislature that would introduce a mechanism for disciplining judicial misconduct has drawn opposition from sitting justices on the state Supreme Court. KGNU's Jack Armstrong has more.
Colorado Senate Bill 22201 calls the formation of a committee to oversee investigations into allegations of wrongdoing by members of the judiciary. The bill, which was introduced last week, comes after years of allegations of corruption and dozens of misconduct allegations within Colorado's court system. Most recently, the Denver Post reported a chief justice paid top administrators $2.5 million to cover up allegations of sexual assault. The bill has already drawn skepticism of Colorado Supreme Court Chief Justice Brian Boatwright. Chief Justice Boatwright says he supports judicial accountability, but remains unconvinced that the provisions of the bill will accomplish the stated aims of the bill's sponsors. Justice Monica Marquez has also expressed concern about the bill as written. Supporters of the bill want an oversight commission that is independent from the court system. Presently, those tasked with judicial oversight are other members of the judiciary. For KGNU, I'm Jack Armstrong.
Colorado Natural Gas's press release on Friday reminded Coloradans to watch out for gas pipelines when digging in their garden during National Safe Digging Month. The Director of Operations at Colorado Natural Gas, or CNG, said that this time of year is when people begin outdoor DIY projects and remind residents to check pipe locations on their property. If you are planning to dig, you can call 811 two working days before you plan to do so, so your utility marks can be recorded, and professional locators can visit the site to mark underground utilities for free. In today's weather, the National Weather Service forecasts sunny skies this week with a high of 65 degrees today with a low of 40. Tuesday night, there is a chance for showers with a high of 64 degrees. Sunny skies and highs in the upper 50s and 60s will return for the rest of the week. Denver should see similar weather with a high of 68 degrees today. Highs in the 60s and 70s and sunny skies are expected to follow for the rest of the week. Temperatures are expected to reach 65 degrees in Fort Collins today. Outside the Boulder studios, it's currently 30 degrees. For KGNU, I'm Ellie Stuckrath.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. Boulder County has a stated aim to get its waste stream down to as close to zero as possible by the year 2025. The county has been working on the transition to zero waste for more than a decade. Here at KGNU, we're going to be checking in on how the transition is going. Today, we present the first in a year-long series that will follow the various waste streams coming out of Boulder County. Jamie Settler has our first story.
It's something we all do several times a day. We take showers, wash our hands, do the dishes, and go to the bathroom. And we probably don't think about where the water and its content go. It's out of sight, out of mind. But not to Dr. Sherry Cook. Thinking about what goes down the drain is her job and her passion.
I'm a wastewater person. For people in my field, that's where it starts for us, right? It's also where the fun starts.
Dr. Cook teaches environmental engineering at the University of Colorado Boulder, and she thinks it's not waste we're flushing down the drain, it's valuable treasure going to waste.
Why are we saying that we're treating this water? Why don't we just manage the resources in the water?
She says there are three components of wastewater that can be managed to our benefit. Nutrients, energy, and water.
Usually we're taking the carbon and we're turning it into an energy source, like methane being the most common. We turn the nitrogen and the phosphorus into some sort of artificial fertilizer, you know, compost or biosolids that you can apply even to your home garden if it's managed and treated well enough.
And of course, there is the water itself that can be cleaned and returned to the river from which it came to support aquatic habitats and for us to drink and irrigate crops. So how does the magic happen? How does sewage go from an ick factor to a valuable commodity? For that answer, we went to the City of Boulder's wastewater treatment plant, which, to reflect the industry's paradigm shift, has a new name.
So welcome to the City of Boulder's Water Resource Recovery Facility. Glad to have you here.
Cole Sigman manages the plant that's logically placed on the east side of the town at a lower elevation that allows gravity to send the waste downhill. He says that when someone in Boulder flushes a toilet, it takes about 2 hours for their contribution to get to the facility and begin its resource recovery journey.
So this is the first step in the process. So it's called a preliminary treatment step.
Upon arrival, sewage travels up what looks like small escalators that remove toilet paper and other debris. It's a loud and pretty smelly place and a bit unnerving to look at. Once an operator found a couple of $100 bills in the raw sewage, and even a caiman, a small alligator that was quickly turned over to wildlife officials. Trash like toilet paper is taken to a landfill after being washed. Then the liquid part goes to clarifiers, concrete circular ponds with long rotating arms that skim grease and other materials that float to the surface.
The effluent from that process gets pumped up to the aeration basins. That's where biology takes over and over the treatment process, and a lot of biology removes not only the organic material but also nutrients.
The basins are large rectangular ponds that aerate the water, which also break up hormones excreted by humans that you may have heard can feminize male fish in rivers. More solids get removed in another set of circular clarifiers, and that sludge is conveyed to anaerobic digesters a few hundred feet away. The effluent without that sludge is run through ultraviolet disinfection and returned to Boulder Creek, flowing just north of the facility. But this is not the end of the story. The sludge, at this point the consistency of tomato soup, is run through centrifuges to get more water removed, and the result is
to something that looks more like brownie mix, which we call biosolids.
Those biosolids get picked up by
about 7 trucks per week back in and get filled up.
Then they are taken to eastern Colorado, where they are used by farmers as fertilizer. The anaerobic digesters that produce the biosolids also produce methane, and after a process that Boulder implemented about a year and a half ago, the gas is put into a pipeline.
So based on the production at the wastewater facility, we are able to power about 65% of our trucks.
That's Kathy Carroll of Western Disposal Services, the company that collects trash, recycling, and compost materials all the way from Nederland in West Boulder County, east to Broomfield, and now even in parts of Jefferson County. About 38 of their 60 collection trucks are running on the renewable natural gas that is produced by the city's water resource recovery facility. Carol showed me a long row of about a dozen hookup stations where what we used to call garbage trucks fill their tanks with natural gas under the shelter covered with solar panels.
In 2010, we decided to begin to transition our fleet from diesel to compressed natural gas. We are a local company, and we really do, we have a direct impact, and we benefit directly from having cleaner air. We live here, we work here, we grow our families here, we are part of this community. So the reduction of natural gas, or excuse me, the reduction of carbon emissions is important to us.
The company has entered a long-term contract with the city to purchase all the gas the water resource recovery plant produces. Could there be other resources that might be recovered from wastewater? Sigmund says that there are several ideas. For one, water moving through pipes is often warm, and that heat could be harnessed to run the plant. Also, Sigmund says that some of the algae that does grow in their clarifiers could be harvested for fertilizer and one day even be used to make shoes. Dr. Cook likes ideas that look at the big picture of how we can use what we used to get rid of.
Right, if we can get more methane from the feces that's coming out of humans and decrease some of the fracking that's happening, there's a huge benefit.
Although challenges lie ahead for the wastewater treatment industry from emerging contaminants like PFAS chemicals and microplastics, Dr. Cook sees them as opportunities to find solutions that might yield unique resources to make a truly circular economy where waste is put to work instead of just circling the drain.
Maybe a little embarrassing to be this passionate about waste, but I do really like it.
From the Boulder Water Resource Recovery Facility, for KGNU, I'm Jamie Sudler.
This reporting series was made possible by a grant from Boulder County Zero Waste Funding Program. There's a new rule on the road in Colorado. Governor Jared Polis signed the Safety Stop Bill last week, which allows bicycles, e-bikes, and electric scooters to legally roll through stop signs if there's no oncoming traffic and proceed through intersections before a light turns green. It's a transit tweak many bicycle advocates here in Colorado have been requesting for years. It's called the Idaho Stop because that's who legalized it first. But the advocates here call it the Safety Stop because all the data from Idaho and every other state that tried it shows that it's safer, a lot safer. But those bicycle advocates never could get the Idaho Stop passed here in Colorado until this year, when someone came along with a fresh perspective. His name is Marcus Robinson, and he's been biking in Denver his whole life. And he sat down recently with CityCast Denver's Paul Caroli.
Marcus Robinson, can you explain for listeners who might not be familiar, what is the Idaho Stop?
It was named, obviously, for in Idaho, but it was passed basically to allow the multimodal type of transportation, meaning bikes and cars can actually operate within the same space. And the way the law is written here in Colorado that we're looking at without the specifics is that cyclists will no longer be ticketed by police authorities for running a stop sign. We will not be ticketed for those types of minor infractions. And so what that means is that if you're a cyclist in your neighborhood, say in Park Hill, and you're coming through a stop sign, you can treat that stop sign as a yield, right? You can look every direction, see that the area is safe. And then once it's safe, you can move on forward and proceed through the intersection. When you come to a traffic light, you will treat that as a stop. You will then look towards, you know, whichever direction, also treat that in a safe mode, meaning you're going to look all ways. And if you see that the intersection is clear, then you can proceed through the intersection. The great thing about that is that it takes cyclists out of that right lane, which is that turning lane, which is the scariest part for all of us. Mm-hmm. Those pinch points that cause accidents where cyclists are all the way over on the right waiting for a light to turn. People are trying to right turn on red or whatever, and they're cutting you off or making gestures at us or so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So what this does is allows us to treat that intersection as a stop, look, make sure that you're okay in all directions, and proceed. And then it's going to really truly decriminalize those types of infractions by law enforcement. You know, those are dangerous interactions. It also, for the people of color in our communities, the BIPOC communities in particular, to have a kid who's riding his bike home from the grocery store with his parents' permission, and he runs a stop sign trying to get home with a bag of groceries, and a police officer would stop him, and instead of educating or something of that nature, you end up getting, well, what's your name? What's your address? And then run the child or whomever through the system and find out whether or not there's anything in their record. That's not needed. You know, it's a waste of law enforcement dollars. So this way, we remove all of those barriers. We make everyone safe that rides a bicycle and just be able to get through an intersection without that random hit.
And I should say, you know, there's data on this. This is something that state-level bicycle advocacy groups for many, many years have been pushing for here in Colorado, and they will always tell you that every state that has legalized the Idaho stop has seen huge, huge reductions in accidents at intersections, which are the problem spots. So it really does work. But what I was excited to talk to you about was that second thing that you were sort of going into already, that decriminalization piece. That's a new element of the conversation, as far as I can tell, here in Colorado. Tell me where that came from. How did you come to testify in favor of this?
It's personal experience. It's personal experience from riding and racing my bike here in Colorado. And it is, for me, it is what has happened to me, right? But on the other hand, I have lots of other friends, you know, in the BIPOC community that have had those same types of interactions. These are things that are never recorded. It's not talked about, but we're harassed, truly. And as I look back towards things that occurred to me when I was learning how to ride a bike and exploring new neighborhoods, we were harassed by cops. We've been accused of stealing bicycles before. We've had our parents have to call and tell, you know, the local, you know, substation that, you know, you've got our kids and no, they didn't steal that bike, things of that nature. And for me, given the opportunity to speak to this at both the state and the Senate, it gives another image of what this law can actually do. And we just don't want to be, and I'm talking about the Black, Indigenous people of color community, we just don't need to be hassled if we're running a stop sign. If we do, okay, if you do, you know, you broke the law. Okay, fine. Educate, right? Let's not just automatically think that that person is bad. So for me to testify, it was a pleasure. It was an honor for me to show another side of this bill that no one seemed to talk about, right? Parents can breathe thinking that their kids are going to be okay now, that they're not going to be hassled, that provided they follow the safety stop law, you know, everything should be fine.
You say the parents can breathe now. I can't help but think about the slogan from the racial justice protests of 2020, I can't breathe, and the connection between your advocacy work and the organization that you run, Ride for Racial Justice. I wonder if you could help me connect those dots a little bit more between the organization's founding and this particular what I used to think as transit reform, but now I think about it as racial justice reform.
You know, when George was murdered, I've been riding my bike my whole life. The country was in a turmoil. I have not seen that since I was a child, watching the riots and demonstrations from the 60s. And where I ride, in particular, where we live, I have access to country roads within about 5 minutes. And it's nothing but two-lane highway, farms and ranches for as far as the eye can see. But my country was changing. George was murdered. People had had enough. We couldn't breathe. We felt that we all had a knee on our neck. And my wife, Sandra, said, I don't want you riding your bike. And I said, I want to ride my bike. And she said, you can't ride your bike. I don't want you to ride your bike. And I started thinking about that. And I said, I can't ride my bike because of how I could be somewhere out in the middle of riding a bike for 50, 60 miles by myself. And somebody that doesn't like me just comes up behind and hits me, puts me in a ditch. And I never come home. America was different. There was a lot of hate in the world at that time. Are we done with it? No, we're not. We're a long way from it. And so I posted something on social media, and my dear friend and co-founder, Neil Henderson, he calls me and he says, you okay? I said, no. And he said, we got to do something about that. I said, okay, well, let's do a ride.
And I know you all did do that ride. You organized one in Five Points, and then I heard about one in Boulder and one in Fort Collins, and I don't know, it sounded like they were a really big deal. It sounded like you really touched a nerve with this idea. Why do you think that is? Why is this such a powerful idea, you know, biking, riding for racial justice?
No one felt afraid to talk because we're on a bike, right? And we're just talking about the weather and kids and schools and how it is, you know, just regular stuff, right? But we're doing it in a way that's never been done, at least within, you know, the way I look at it, right? Is that you're just not going to walk up to a person that doesn't look like you and start talking about race relations in America. That's just not going to happen, right? They're going to cut you out or, you know, walk away and stuff like that. Neither side is going to win in that argument. But in this particular case, people are talking. And we just learned so much about each other, right? And there was this one lady, she pulls up next to me, and just to show you, we're not going fast, right? We're just kind of cruising. Mm-hmm. And she says, I'm one of those women. I said, what do you mean? She says, I'm white and I'm privileged. And these types of things don't occur in my neighborhood. And whoa, okay? From a bike, right? And we talked all the way around for 7 miles. We just chatted.
Wow.
You know, and she said, why aren't we doing this? I said, well, here we are. Okay, so we're the first one. Let's just keep building on this.
Well, Marcus, thank you again so much for your time and for the conversation.
I'm glad to talk about it, and I thank you for doing that.
You just heard an excerpt from CityCast Denver, the local Denver daily news podcast. Learn more about subscribing to the podcast at denver.citycast.fm or wherever you get your podcasts.
Before we go, a look at what's coming up on this afternoon's Metro Show. April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and every year there are courses in communities, schools, and organizations. Yet, data shows sexual harassment is on the rise, including in our digital world. Today, Metro host Miriam Schiff visits with Dr. Janine Danabel, Director of Trauma Services for Moving to End Sexual Assault.
Just because it's via text or some social media platform, things can and do happen, right, that are unwanted and inappropriate. So we first just have to name that to raise awareness for our kids, each other, right? And the other thing, Miriam, that's really important with this is we've made some progress in talking about consent, you know, in a physical situation, when you have a, you know, in-person relationship with someone, or, you know, we can talk about, well, if someone touches you in this way, that if you don't want it, that's sexual assault, right? But we don't have the language to talk about what someone might do in a virtual space.
That's coming up on this afternoon's Metro show at 3 p.m. right here on KGNU. That's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Ariana Proctor. Special thanks to Ellie Stuckrath, Jack Armstrong, Alexis Kenyon, Miriam Schiff, Jada Rodriguez, Rosanna Longo-Better, and Shannon Young for their contributions to today's program. If you'd like to comment us on something you heard on KGNU, you can leave us a voicemail at 303-447-9911. We play the messages back on Tuesdays during the Morning Magazine. Stay tuned for a commentary from Jim Hightower. And then it's good old CU with Jim Juhas. That's just after these news headlines from the BBC.